most busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today on this hot summer Tuesday, it's July 17th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end senseless marijuana prohibition in America. Legalization won't happen without your support, so make sure you join or donate to Normal today. You can join online at norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL. This week here on the Audio Stash, we're featuring a number of Best of Audio Stash episodes. That's because I'm taking a couple days of vacation. We're going to be back next week strong with brand new episodes, and next week we'll likely bring the House floor debate and vote on the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment. That's an amendment to protect patients in states that have legalized medical marijuana access from federal government intrusion. That means this amendment could stop the DEA from raiding patients and facilities in states that have locally authorized legal medical marijuana access. We'll have Congressman Maurice Hinchey in a brand new interview on the program next week. We'll also speak with Congressman Ron Paul, who's been a longtime supporter of this amendment, right here on the Audio Stash. So big week in politics next week, and there's been a lot of news that we're going to recap on Friday's Audio Stash this week. But today, tomorrow, and Thursday, we've got some best of episodes. In today's show, we'll hear from economist Jeffrey Miron. He's from Harvard University and has studied the subject of taxing and regulating marijuana. We spoke with Jeff on April 16th during our 420 week episodes, but it was also tax day. So here's our April 16th interview with economist Jeffrey Miron. You can find more about Jeff and read his full reports on our website at normalaudiostash.com. In 2005, the Marijuana Policy Project funded an economic study of the possible outcomes of taxing and regulating marijuana in a manner similar to alcohol. It wasn't surprising that there would be some revenue generated. What was a surprise was just how much revenue could be there. The full report can be found online at the website www.prohibitioncosts.org. We have links to that report up on our homepage today. When the report was initially released, it did serve as a catalyst for Nobel laureate Milton Friedman and 500 additional economists to issue an open letter in the New York Times calling for a regulated marijuana market here in the U.S. Joining us to discuss the dollars and cents of taxing and regulating marijuana is the author of that report, Harvard economist Jeffrey Miron. Jeff, welcome to the program today.
Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to speak with you on this final day before our taxes are due to the IRS, Jeff. So how much can we make from regulating and taxing marijuana?
Well, from the taxation of marijuana, my estimates are that we'd get between sort of $3 and $6 billion annually. The exact amount depends, of course, on what the tax rate is. If we taxed it like all other goods, we're talking, say, $3 billion. If we taxed it the way we taxed alcohol and tobacco, probably more like $6 to $7 billion.
And when we talk about the model used for alcohol and tobacco, Jeff, how does that differ from how we tax other goods?
Well, most regular goods are subject to standard state sales taxes, which vary from, say, 4% to maybe 7 or 8% in the highest taxation state. For alcohol and tobacco, we have tax rates that might account for 30, 50, in a few cases even 60, 70% of the price. So those tax rates are much, much higher.
So could localities benefit as well? Cities, you know, could they benefit as well as the state and the Fed?
That would depend. They certainly could. There are city-level sales taxes in some places. For the most part, the taxation of these commodities like alcohol and tobacco are partially federal and partially state, and then states, of course, then share them with their municipalities to a great degree.
So, Jeff, there's a system already in place that could be used to tax marijuana. Is that what I'm hearing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the standard sales taxes exist in every state or almost every state for the vast majority of goods. Those systems are somewhat complicated in some places because there are various exemptions and special cases. But likewise, we have standard excise taxes, or some people call them sin taxes, for alcohol and tobacco. So we'd be using exactly the same system. It would simply incorporate an additional commodity.
And being an economist, you know, have you spoken to others in your field? How do other economists view this concept?
I've spoken to lots, and a number of economists reviewed my study and were supportive of the general conclusions. I think that there is a subgroup of economists who are somewhat nervous about the taxation and regulation approach. They're worried that many more people would use marijuana if it were legalized and regulated, and that might lead to some health or productivity or other problems, but I think both would agree that the evidence does not suggest significant effects along those lines, and indeed the evidence suggests that marijuana is a safer commodity overall than alcohol or tobacco. So I think generally speaking you would get reasonably good support from economists for the approach that I'm proposing.
And is there really any other single item that could cause such a positive financial correction for our economy?
Well, let me first emphasize that I wouldn't want to take it as given that we need to be collecting more tax revenue, so I think we should be spending a lot less money and therefore overall need less tax revenue. But given the level of spending that we choose, whatever that is, marijuana and other illegal drugs are obvious suggestions. The main other one would be prostitution, which is the main other illegal commodity on which we're not collecting tax revenue except in a few places like Nevada, and that's a significant industry where there would be a lot of tax revenue to be gained.
Jeff, when your report came out, there was also included some idea of how this added revenue could be spent, one of which was securing loose nuclear weapons in the Soviet Union. Another was part of border security with the Coast Guard. So taxing and regulating marijuana could really serve in some ways to increase national security.
That's true, although I would emphasize a different point, which is a dollar of tax revenue is just a dollar, so it can be spent on whatever society thinks is the right kind of expenditure, whether it's education, hospitals, national defense, anything. There doesn't and shouldn't be any link between the source of the revenue and the use of the revenue, and whether those things that were described by MPP are the best choices of any additional tax revenue, that's a completely different question, and I didn't get into that at all in my report.
And Jeffrey, did it surprise you when Milton Friedman and that group of 500 economists took your report as a catalyst for writing their open letter?
No, I don't think it's particularly surprising, because the approach that we were talking about is one that's familiar to basically all economists, the taxation and regulation, and there's a pretty clear argument why if society wants to reduce the consumption of a particular commodity, say alcohol or tobacco, the better approach is to have it be a legal commodity but raise its price via taxation, okay, rather than driving it underground. If you prohibit it and drive it underground, a bunch of negative things happen, and under pretty broad conditions, one can argue from economics that the taxation regulation approach is both more effective and uses resources much more efficiently overall. Basically, when you drive it underground, a lot of resources are wasted in the black market and don't benefit sort of society generally. When you tax it, those tax revenues are simply a transfer from people buying to the general public, and the public can use those to fund whatever society chooses.
Jeff, most of the alcohol market is controlled by these large companies here in the U.S., but you know, could a regulated marijuana market lend itself to more small business involvement?
There certainly would be small businesses. Undoubtedly, there would still continue to be people who would grow their own, just as there are people who make their own beer, a few. There are people who grow their own tomatoes and so on. My guess, however, is that, in fact, we would see an industry that looked pretty similar to the alcohol and tobacco industries. A relatively small number of manufacturers would account for a very large fraction of the market, and then there would be lots of small fringe players like microbreweries for beer and boutique wineries and things like that. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that's just what the economics would dictate, but it doesn't really matter from the perspective of the beneficial effects of the alternative approach, of the taxation and regulation approach. Society still has the right to regulate the time and place of use, for example, to have driving under the influence laws that apply to marijuana as well as to alcohol. Indeed, most places already have such laws. So that's just a separate question from how the structure of the industry worked out.
Your report also looked at another aspect of pot economics here in the research, and that regarded the judicial and legal expenditures made out there every day due to prohibition. Tell us a little bit about your findings there.
Well, that's actually a somewhat bigger number. My estimate is that's in the ballpark of $8 billion a year. So that's at least as large as the tax benefits. And that actually is a net savings in resources. It's not simply a transfer from one group to another group. So again, that's an improvement in overall government budgets that can be used for other purposes, whether those are tax cuts or whether those are additional hospitals, schools, national security, or whatever.
So combined with the revenues generated by the actual taxing of marijuana as a commodity, with these legal savings as well, this could be a really big financial benefit, especially to the states.
Yeah, I think it's important not to overstate it. I mean, my estimates would be more in the sort of 10 to 14 billion range, and if we look at the federal deficit right now, we're talking hundreds of billions. So it's not a solution to everybody's problems by any stretch, but it's the sensible approach, even setting aside the budgetary implications. And the budgetary implications are just sort of gravy. They're just sort of a bonus on top of the fact that it's a better approach anyway.
Well, Jeffrey, this has been a very informative discussion today. And again, I really appreciate you joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much again. Jeffrey Myron is an economist, and he's currently at Harvard University. Listeners can read his full 2005 report, The Budgetary Implications of Marijuana Prohibition, online at the website www.prohibitioncosts.org. And we have links to that on our homepage today as well at normalaudiostash.com. Our interview with Jeffrey Myron was originally aired on April 16th, 2007. Up next today is our most recent interview with one of America's most renowned cannabinoid researchers, Dr. Robert Malamede from the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs Biology Department. Dr. Bob has his own podcast. You can check it out. It's called Dr. Bob's Cannabuzz. We have links to Dr. Bob's homepage on our website at normalaudiostash.com. He joined us on April 30th, 2007. To discuss recent news about marijuana potency, and he gave us some truth about high-potency pot.
Howdy, my pleasure to be here.
It's great to speak with you again, Doctor. We're going to talk about pot potency here on the Audio Stash today. We're seeing this resurgence in totally outrageous and frankly idiotic reefer madness from the UK and even U.S. drug warriors on this issue. They say that marijuana is much more potent than it was in the 60s. But didn't they used to test a lot of hemp, a lot of ditchweed that was seized in the past?
Well, a lot of what's confiscated by the government in terms of the plants that they rip up has historically been ditchweed. There was a study done a number of years ago where they showed that something like 98% or some high, very high 90s number of the plants that are uprooted in this country are ditchweed. So, you know, that's of course going to bias their statistics down a little bit. The question we might ask is, why are they spending millions of dollars to rip up ditchweed?
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, they also found that the highest THC levels were found in Oregon marijuana, where there are a number of absolutely wonderful cultivators. But I have to ask, I know we've touched on this in the past, but is marijuana really that more potent even then in the 60s? I mean, was there always some high THC marijuana available?
Well, I remember back when I was, you know, a lot younger than I am now, we had things like Panama Gold, you know, Panama Red and Acapulco Gold, and they were quite a surprise when you first toked up on those. But I can distinctly remember what we did. We rolled little teeny thin pin joints. When we had that compared to the, you know, the kind of trashy brick Colombian that we were smoking for the most part back then. So I think there's a history of having available high quality, high potency marijuana. It's just that I think because of the, essentially because of the drug war and the crackdown that has occurred focused largely on marijuana, they've driven people indoors, that's promoted cultivation, and it's allowed people to select all these various strains that are available today, which include strains with increased potency. So it's kind of like the law of unintended consequences once again. You know, they tightened up on illegal imports, and they fostered a domestic market that had talent and desire to produce better marijuana. So once again, the narrow-minded people have kind of screwed themselves with respect to their narrow-minded aims.
You mentioned something interesting there that Paul Armentano stated in the Normal press release last week, ended in his interview here on The Stash, that cannabis consumers self-regulate their intake and really don't go too far. And that seems like a unique thing to marijuana users, unlike alcohol, where folks can drink themselves dead at a party in one night.
Well, I think unlike things like cocaine, for example, where people tend to become kind of like fiends, you know, every 10 minutes or 15 minutes they want more, and it really becomes kind of a pathological drive. You don't see that with marijuana for the most part. I mean, of course, there are going to be some people who are gluttons and abuse it, but that's not the majority of the people out there consuming. So, you know, it's very much of a different situation. I think real insight is gained from looking at an animal study where they gave mice low doses. And this is a critical thing. So much of the research, even still done today, is done with doses that are way beyond what I would consider reasonable for a person who gets high. And when I'm saying this, I'm talking about using synthetics in either animals or in tissue culture models in an effort to learn more about the multiple effects that cannabinoids have on our bodies. But the point is, there was a study done a number of years ago where they gave animals very low doses, and they allowed them to self-administer. And basically what, you know, if you translate, you know, how much they were taking per weight of a mouse to a human, it comes down to they like to take a couple of hits.
Now, we're really talking about recreational smokers here, but medical users can sometimes be using much more marijuana than recreational smokers.
Not just THC, though. It's the constellation of cannabinoids that produce a variety of synergistic effects. You know, one of the important factors that's often neglected is that there are about over 60 cannabinoid active chemicals in marijuana that have a whole variety of effects that kind of meld together to produce the effect that you get from smoking marijuana, which is quite distinct from what happens if you eat a THC pill, which the government has decided is a safe, effective thing for people to use. You know, they made it a class 3.
Let's talk about that for a moment, Bob. John Walters, the drug czar, and Nora Volko of the National Institutes on Drug Abuse, they would have us believe that 10% THC is somehow really dangerous. But Marinol is 100% THC, and it's FDA approved.
Well, and there's a lot of factors to consider there. Most people who are consuming marijuana recreationally are smoking it, or at least in many cases are moving more to things that are healthier, like vaporizers. But the key factor from both of those routes of entry is that you can self-titrate, because the effects occur at a fairly, you know, over a fairly short period of time. So that you can see where you're at, and you know, people, I mean, how many times have you people said, no, I'm all right, you know, people are passing joints and somebody reaches the point that they want to, you know, I'm okay, and they don't take anymore. So that's kind of the norm. People, just like those mice, like to get a certain level of altered consciousness, which, you know, what does it really mean getting high? It means you're relaxed, you're open-minded, you're extra sensitive to sensations and feelings. You know, a lot of positive things. It's actually like turning on your life more, because you're relaxed and able to feel and think and experience yourself. So if you take too much, you tend to not be able to do that because you tend to become immobile. I mean, see, that's the thing, again, about eating it versus smoking it. You smoke it, you self-titrate, and I think the dangers come in, for especially for novices who are maybe, you know, eating it for the first time, and they eat too much. And the same can be true, said to be true of people smoking high-potency marijuana when they're using it for the first time, and they don't understand that you don't just go and smoke a joint. You know, you smoke to reach a certain level, and a lot of times, which is actually quite interesting, people who are novices, they smoke and they don't feel anything. So they keep smoking more, and they don't feel anything, and they keep smoking more, and they don't feel anything, and all of a sudden that little window opens up, and they say, whoa, you know, and by that time it might be too late. So, you know, if the government really cared about the individuals of our society, in particular the youth of our society, rather than making them into criminals, we should have educational programs to teach people how to use marijuana constructively and effectively, and especially for first-time users, so that they don't take too much and you know, receive uncomfortable effects. And considering uncomfortable effects, that takes us back again to Marinol. Marinol being pure THC, it lacks some of the counterbalancing effects that you find within the plant. For example, CBD, cannabidiol, is what's known as anxiolytic. It breaks anxiety. Whereas straight THC is anxiogenic, meaning it makes anxiety. So if you're smoking the plant as opposed to taking that pill, you not only can titrate your dose, but you're going to have something that counters a lot of the negative effects of straight THC. And the pathetic situation is that here we have sick people, people, you know, suffering from cancer and other illnesses, and the government has approved a drug from them that's going to make them anxious, just what they need, and not allow them to self-titrate so that they're going to tend to take too much.
And we've mentioned this a few times, that cannabis consumers really do look for a certain level of intoxication, then stop their smoking session when they reach that point. But is there anything to say that higher THC marijuana actually makes people like pot more?
No, I think if anything, it might make them like it less, because once people have an unpleasant experience with anything, they tend to not go back to doing it. So if you give somebody a dose that makes them uncomfortable and unhappy and, you know, feeling insecure and anxious and whatever, they're not going to tend to use it. So if anything, I would think that it might have the opposite effect.
And for, you know, for teenagers in particular, you know, they're being sent to treatment, usually because they're given the option in front of a judge, you know, go to treatment or go to jail. But, you know, for teenagers who do want to stop using marijuana, do they need medical treatment? I mean, is the sort of traditional treatment used for, say, alcoholics something that would be successful with a marijuana user?
Well, there's two things we should look at here. One is that people who use marijuana, for the most part, stop using it. I mean, we know the numbers. You know, how many people use it when they're young and stop using it when they have less time and less, you know, a more controlled life. They have jobs, they have families, etc. The bulk of people who use marijuana early stop using it. Well, if it was a dangerous, addictive drug, they would not be able to do that. So, I mean, the data there clearly dispels that rumor. On the other hand, there are people with addictive natures for anything. You know, there are people who drink 10 bottles of Coca-Cola a day, clearly something harmful and not healthy. And there are similar people who sit around and smoke joints all day and do nothing, just like in the advertisements that the government puts out in the ads. But that's the minority of people. You know, I know so many contributing members of society, family members, professionals with wonderful jobs and, you know, demanding jobs, and they love to consume because it's an intellectual way of altering your consciousness. It's not like drinking alcohol and becoming an idiot.
So, and, you know, and is 15 or 20% THC in marijuana, is that as high as it gets, or can we get even higher THC levels?
Well, I think the highest that they've recorded has been something like 28% or something up there, close to 30.
Wow.
But, you know, there's a limit because, of course, the plant has to live, which means it can't, you know, you can't just turn the plant into 100% THC because it needs to be alive, which means it has to be doing all the other things necessary for life. Kind of true of people, too. You know, if somebody sits and smokes all the time and does nothing else with their life, they're not alive.
We're with Dr. Robert Malamede of the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, one of the world's leading cannabinoid and endocannabinoid researchers. Bob, no one involved seriously in marijuana law reform or marijuana science will say that pot is 100% harmless for everybody. THC is certainly a non-toxic substance, but in the interest of setting a good example for the thoughtless, blind-to-science opposition out there, there is a small subset of people who may experience some detriment to smoking marijuana. Is that right?
In an effort to be fair, unlike the other side, which is blindly obsessed with their dogma, cannabis is not good for everyone. You know, there are people who are predisposed to schizophrenia, and I think there's pretty good evidence that pot can help foster that in that subpopulation. So, you know, if there's a kid with a history of a family history of schizophrenia, they probably shouldn't have it. And if things like that were more readily known and people were more educated in the constructive safe use of cannabis instead of the fear-mongering, we'd probably, in general, have a lot less problems and a lot more people benefiting from it. You have to remember that cannabis literally works everywhere in our body because we have this endocannabinoid system. And in general, what our endocannabinoids are doing is they're kind of regulating our body balance, homeostasis. And they're regulating a lot of things in our brain. And what has been found in schizophrenics is that they have extraordinarily high levels of some of these endocannabinoids in their blood when they're having schizophrenic episodes. So there may be quite a direct link to the kind of imbalance that these people have that could be further augmented by cannabis consumption in a way unique and different from other drugs to some extent, because it turns out that other drugs like alcohol, like heroin, like tobacco, they funnel through the cannabinoid pathways in our brain. So it's a very complicated situation. It's far from being all sorted out because we know so little about the nature of consciousness and, you know, what's really going on in the little worlds that we look out of our minds from.
And to be clear here, folks, there are only about 1.5 million Americans who are thought to suffer some type of schizophrenic brain disorder out there, while over 4.5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, and THC in particular has been shown to possibly be a revolutionary treatment for that disease.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Well, see, that's again the thing, this weighing off. What we've done is, we as, meaning the government, I shouldn't include me in that, but what our government has done is they focused on the few things that they can justifiably at least quote some science on now, because, you know, the science has come out so overwhelmingly in many cases in a way suggesting that there's benefits to using cannabis. So what they do is they focus on the negative things, like this association with schizophrenia, also like potential impairment of reproductive function, because it's absolutely true. The female uterus, for example, makes loads of endocannabinoids, and they're turned down at the point of ovulation because they have to be low in order for the fertilized egg to implant in the uterus. If it's high, implantation cannot happen. So clearly there's an association there, a clear scientific link with why a woman who's trying to get pregnant should not consume large quantities of marijuana. In addition, there's comparable studies showing that the development of the sperm and its maturation and the ability to join with the egg is also regulated by endocannabinoids. And when I say regulated, I mean that we have to have enough, but we don't want to have too much in both of these cases. So there is certainly a potential association with reproductive behavior. You know, that's true. And those are the only things that the government tends to look at. You know, they used to tell us how bad smoking was, but now, and it is bad. I mean, but it doesn't cause lung cancer. It causes emphysema and other respiratory illnesses, but it doesn't cause lung cancer. So they can't keep peddling the argument, oh, there's five times more carcinogens in marijuana than tobacco, even if that were completely true, which was not because of the nature of what they studied when they did that, you know, when they came to that conclusion. Again, there is a fundamental difference between tobacco smoke and marijuana smoke in that tobacco smoke unambiguously causes lung cancer, and marijuana smoke, if it does so at a dramatically reduced rate. And in fact, recent studies are showing that marijuana kills lung cancer cells. You know, a lot of cancers are directly killed by cannabis. And this is something that a lot of people are very excited about because they're looking to develop new cancer therapies based on cannabinoids.
serve you.
Well, there's some real interesting stuff in the works regarding that. I'm actually fortunate enough to be a founder of a company that resulted from a very brilliant friend of mine and the ideas that she developed. You know, cancer cells and all of our cells, anything requires energy to live. And it turns out that there are ways that we can modulate the energy use patterns, which happens to be different in cancer cells from normal cells, so we can basically block their energy access in a way that's going to provide a revolutionary treatments for cancer.
Bob, this has been fascinating, and I can't wait to speak with you again to talk about that work that you're doing. But we're out of time here today. I want to give you a big thank you. Many thanks for joining us here today to talk about this.
My pleasure.
Thank you again, Bob. Dr. Robert Malamede is a professor of biology at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. He's one of the world's leading cannabinoid and endocannabinoid researchers. We have links to Dr. Bob's homepage as well as his own podcast, Dr. Bob's Cannabuzz. Links to those are available on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. We'll be covering the pot potency issue further this week, right here on your first source for good marijuana information, Normal's Daily Audio Stash. That interview with Dr. Robert Malamede aired originally on April 30th, 2007. We have links to Dr. Bob up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Now it's time for some best of music here on the Audio Stash. We found this one up at podshow.com. He's a musician named Tomas from Europe. And here's this track. Let's get high.
Let's get high. And if we get down, we'll get high. next neighbor. Let's get high. And if we get down, we'll give it another try. Let's get high. Right through the rainbow, let the stars pass me by. Let's get high.
You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.